have all of you here this evening who are here in person, and we want to welcome all of those who are watching this live broadcast. I request that you turn your cell phones off. I've just turned mine off, or put it on vibrate and try to refrain from texting for the next hour. So tonight we're going to have a panel, and we're going to explore working waterfronts. We're going to explore what they are, whether or not they're important, give you some examples of working waterfronts in Southern California, ask what's happening to our working waterfronts and whether we should be concerned about the trends, and if we are, is there anything that we can do about it? We have three outstanding panelists. I think it would be hard to find three people better qualified to discuss this topic. We have in the middle Dr. James Fawcett. Jim is a social scientist. He's been involved in numerous panels at the local, regional, national, and international levels on this topic. He's a researcher and a faculty member in the fields of marine science and urban policy at USC. He serves as the Director of Marine Science and Policy Outreach for the USC Sea Grant Program. He's a former naval officer with service in Vietnam during the late 60s and the early 70s. In the 90s, he served as Chief of Planning for the LA County Department of Beaches and Harbors. And for more than 20 years, he has engaged academicians and trade professionals on issues of environmental politics, port economics, and marine transportation, particularly in the seagoing nations of South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and China. At the far end, Mark Helvey, recently retired from NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service after a distinguished career of 30 years. He retired too early. During that period, he was involved with recreational fisheries, natural resource damage assessments, and essential fish habitat. He was the Assistant Regional Administrator for Sustainable Fisheries for the Southwest region, emphasizing the conservation and management of highly migratory and coastal pelagic species. His present interests revolve around seeking sustainable fishing opportunities for U.S. harvesters and producers, and he's writing some important articles. Closest to me is Don Kent. Don Kent has led Hub SeaWorld Research Institute as its president since 1998. He went to the institute in 1977 as a graduate student from San Diego State University, and he was working on the growth characteristics of striped bass. He has participated in numerous institute programs studying gray whales, assessing noise effects on marine animals, minimizing killer whale impacts on fishing operations, and closest to his interest, the development of a marine finfish aquaculture industry. He is the institute's principal investigator in their offshore aquaculture program, and he is serving as the pro tem and the pro bono CEO of the Rose Canyon Fisheries Project during the permitting process. This is a finfish aquaculture operation that has been proposed for off our coast, a little north of San Diego and just outside of state waters. So all three of these individuals have made and continue to make important contributions to this aquarium by participating in courses, lectures, helping design exhibits, and we are very grateful to them. And I think it's very clear that fisheries and aquaculture, they need boats, they need dock facilities, packing and plants, processing facilities, so they need working waterfronts. And ports may be the ultimate example of working waterfronts. You go out of here in the daytime and you look over and you see all those cranes and those big container ships. So we're going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to move over with you guys.
What do we mean by working waterfront? Jim, we'll start with you. What's a working waterfront? Then I'll ask the other two to add to it.
Sure, thanks, Jerry. A working waterfront is a waterfront. First of all, let's put this in a little bit of context. Our seaports are few in number compared to the overall size of our coastlines, for starters. A working waterfront is one that actually has coastal-related industry along its its coastline. A working waterfront is one where industries that need to be on the coast have a place to be, and in fact, where other related marine industries can be located nearby. So you have a cluster, what economists would call an agglomeration economy. And the working waterfronts are particularly important so that you get this interaction between users of the waterfront. Very important.
What would either of you, would you add to that? Don, how about that? What would you add?
Well, I think besides the interaction with the water itself, there's also the infrastructure that's built onshore to bring product to and away from the waterfront. So railheads and freeways and the ability to offload cargo or load cargo is an important consideration. Distribution of fisheries products, as you mentioned earlier, fish processing, it doesn't just sit at the dock, it then gets moved out to somewhere else. And so you need to have rail and truck and air capabilities. Then, of course, the support of that infrastructure, taking, for example, a single industry like fisheries, where you have not only the vessels themselves that are catching the fish and offloading them, but also the boat repairs and the paint shops and everything else that supports that industry. So really a growth, both direct and indirect, upstream, downstream, of the actual interaction of what happens to the water is really, I think, what's meant by working waterfront.
Mark, would you add anything to this?
I think it's important to kind of characterize what are these businesses, and I think they can be, I tend to break them up into three different areas. One is living marine resources, so that would be commercial fishing, seafood processing and aquaculture. A second category would be marine transport. And then I think a third that a lot of times gets overlooked is the coastal tourism and recreational opportunities. And those all require infrastructure. They all require land to undertake those activities. And then, as both speakers have mentioned, the ability to move those products and those activities back and forth.
The working waterfront is one that is home to coastal-related industries or clusters, and you have to have the supporting infrastructure to support those. I guess I'm a little bit worried, or not worried, but puzzled that you added recreation and tourism. By that measure, Southern California is doing just fine. Does that belong in this category?
Yeah.
It does, Jim. Yeah. I trust you. You're a social scientist.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. So that's good. But the others also have to be accommodated. Give us several examples of different kinds of working waterfronts then in Southern California. So when people want to take a drive this weekend to see a working waterfront, where might they go? Well, who wants to start? How about you?
Okay.
We'll start with you.
Well, I know San Diego better than any others. I mean, as we were having a meeting earlier today, I was looking at an aerial photo of Long Beach and Los Angeles Harbor, and it's fairly well defined. I mean, standing here at the aquarium, you can look off to the west and see very large cranes for offloading materials. Down in San Diego, it tends to get mixed up a little bit. You've got right next to a commercial fishing landing, you've got an area that's set aside for restaurants and hotels. And you have a convention center, and our airport is right in the downtown area. So we have 40 acres dedicated to rental cars to service the not necessarily required for a working waterfront, but that's the space that was available when they needed the rental car space. So, and then, as Mark suggests, there's a lot of tourism mixed in across there. And I know we'll talk about changes we've observed over time, but we have a beautiful waterfront, but it seems like our priorities have kind of changed over time. We put more priority towards the individual person's access to the waterfront and it's the view line to it than other uses.
Right.
It seems to be a rate limiting factor for other types of development now.
So Jim, what would you add to that? Do you want me to go this week? And you've been telling me where to go for many years.
I'll keep doing that. San Diego's a great example because San Diego has all sorts of interesting characteristics to its working waterfront. It has a major shipyard, National Steel and Shipbuilding, really important major shipyard on the West Coast, building huge ships both for the, you know, the commercial industry and also for the Navy. Then it's got, in addition to that, it has lots of coastal recreation. And as Mark said, you know, a lot of access to the waterfront for people who have boats there. There are facilities to get down to the water, hotels, et cetera, et cetera. Your convention center should not be on the water.
No argument.
That is not coastal dependent.
Right.
And fortunately, Petco Park is a little bit away from the waterfront because the ballpark doesn't need to be there. But actually, the San Diego waterfront is really fascinating as compared to L.A. Long Beach. And one of the complaints about L.A. Long Beach, I think, that the public might have is that there isn't enough recreational access to the waterfront, that it is so industrial that they can't get there. On the other hand, L.A. Long Beach supports a huge amount of industry, both at the waterfront and near the waterfront, just as you were saying, Don. Mm-hmm. So the two are so different, and yet they serve different needs.
Right.
So I think that's fascinating.
Mark, what would you add to this?
As both speakers were talking, you look at San Diego, which is maybe a little more compact than L.A. Long Beach, but you have gradations of that throughout the Southern California Bight. So different scales of that same model, and different emphases in those different ports. So as you move from San Diego up to Oceanside, Carlsbad, Dana Point, there are different features of those different harbors, all the way up to Morro Bay, a little above the Bight, all service different types of these businesses.
What about San Pedro? Isn't that an interesting example of a working waterfront, cheek to jowl with the Port of L.A.? You can eat there, and you look skeptical, Jim.
No, I'm not skeptical at all. I mean, San Pedro is fascinating because it has always been a working waterfront.
Right.
The fishing industry, the tuna industry was huge in San Pedro. San Pedro obviously has an incredible amount of shipping going on at the waterfront, as does Long Beach. What's interesting about San Pedro as opposed to Long Beach is that because of the configuration of the San Pedro Harbor, of the Port of LA, there's an opportunity for at least some public access in close proximity to shipping and to container shipping. And that's fascinating for the public because they can see container ships going by, they can watch container operations underway. It's hard to do that in the Port of Long Beach because the way the Port of Long Beach is configured, I mean, here we are, we're in the waterfront right here, but it's a little hard to really see the commerce going on, except, as Don was saying, to see the trucks moving by. So San Pedro offers some sort of unique opportunities in that respect. And actually, that's good. We want the public to be able to see what's going on at the waterfront because the public is going to be, this is a really important point, be advising their elected officials about how to manage the waterfront. If the public doesn't understand what goes on there, they're going to give bad advice to their public officials. And by advice, I mean they're not going to vote for public officials who actually are advocating the what I would consider to be the appropriate use of the waterfront.
Right, and I would agree. I wish the Port of Long Beach were closer to us. We don't see the ships. We can see them out at anchor waiting to come in, but we certainly see the trucks on the 710.
Right.
All right, is mixed use important in defining a working waterfront? Jim, if it's not mixed use, does it still qualify?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
My sense is that a working waterfront makes a better use of the space when it is mixed, right, when there is an opportunity for the public to get there, but but not too much opportunity. And, you know, I know you don't want to talk about this right now, but if we talk about housing on the waterfront, that's too much access to the waterfront.
We're going to come back to that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be mixed use, obviously, to be a working waterfront, but maybe the value does go up when you have more than a single use. Would the two of you agree with that?
Well, I think back to the concept of infrastructure, I think that multiple different types of industry down there have similar requirements as far as their needs go.
Right.
So vessel repair and maintenance and that type of thing is certainly an example. But I think there needs to be some delineation that, you know, with safety as a consideration. You can't have forklifts that are offloading seafood going across a sidewalk that has three-year-old toddlers walking back and
right.
forth. So you need to have some sort of separation
right.
from the casual tourist and pedestrian from, you know, heavily industrialized uses.
Okay.
Jerry, I want to say something here, too, about, and if there's anybody sitting here who's from Northern California, just shut your ears for a minute. The Fisherman's Wharf area of San Francisco
yeah.
is a boutique waterfront.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's a single-use waterfront, but and yes, the public can get there, but it's not a vigorous waterfront compared to the waterfront that we were talking about in San Diego or in LA Long Beach.
Right. We'll come back to the yuppification of the waterfront later. Okay. Is it important that we save working waterfronts? Mark?
Oh, absolutely. Economically, culturally, historically. I mean, they're all part of our heritage. But again, it goes back to having access for these businesses. And if you have a non-working waterfront, you're not going to have those types of businesses. So it's an absolute yes.
So economically and culturally, that's interesting. So are working waterfronts important in driving coastal tourism? No?
I work next door to SeaWorld, so, you know, it's right on Mission Bay, and it's a fantastic resource for education and for enjoyment. And I think you have to make those types of provisions, but all of Mission Bay is strictly for recreational use. You can have a vessel there, but your business has to be recreationally oriented. Down in San Diego Bay, it's a little bit different. And I think we can zone things properly so that we don't have cross interference. But back to the concept of it's important. In a lot of cases, we've already made the investment. And in some regards, those are investments that would be almost impossible to replace in this day and age. The permitting to put in a jetty or to put in a boat ramp or something like that is far more complicated than it was back in the 50s and the 60s when a lot of this infrastructure is in place. Not to jump ahead for your yuppification issue, but, you know, we have our, right across from our county offices in San Diego Bay, we have the Embarcadero where tuna boats used to be lined up. Now we have a maritime museum and contests for what kind of art will be put there. And the tuna boats are gone, and the docks are still there, but it's a walkway now and parking. It's not a working commercial. It's not generating revenues from landings of tuna or other fisheries products.
In New England, fishing villages really are important drivers of tourism. People like to go to restaurants and look out at the fishing boats. Maybe that's less true in Southern California. If you can get close to big ships, where you have a restaurant where you can look out at big ships going by, that's the kind of waterfront I like to go to as a tourist.
I don't think it has to even be a big ship, Jerry. I think even a small fishing vessel coming in and unloading is going to have that same impact on that family that drove in for the day to enjoy the water. And so it's a range of those uses, again, that I think are key.
What are the biggest threats to working waterfronts? And let's start with Southern California. Jim, you travel more than any of us. You're going where next? You've been in South Korea. You're going to China or something. I occasionally get to Oxnard. So tell us, what are the major threats to working waterfronts in Southern California?
Well, I don't know that there are terrible threats to working waterfronts necessarily around here. Let me switch gears on you and shift to what you were just talking about, the Northeast. There, the threat is, you were calling it yuppification. It's the loss of important commercially zoned land uses on the port or on the seaport to residential uses. Right. Once a residential use, once a parcel of land is transferred into residential use from a commercial use, it is very difficult for it to go back again. And if we consider that there is some option value in keeping those parcels of land at the waterfront, even in a holding status for other commercial activities, if we allowed those parcels to become residentially used, I mean, think about it. If you buy a house or you buy a condo, which it would be, on the waterfront, I mean, your mortgage is for 30 years. Somehow, for that property to revert again to a commercial use, somebody's probably either going to have to pay a lot of money, or somebody's going to lose a lot of money, and there's a public value in retaining the ability to have commercial uses at the waterfront. The yuppification may be cool for the people who live there, but they outbid commercial users.
Years ago, I spent a lot of time studying Chesapeake Bay, and a couple of years ago, I went back to some of the fishing villages like Rock Hall and Crisfield. When I was back there working, there were fishing boats. They were wonderful places to go and have a meal and look at the fishing boats coming in. Now they're all condos. And in Maine, there's even a more pernicious effect. If you go in, if I have a small operation, maybe I have a fish market. If you go in being a wealthy professor and you buy up a piece of property next to me and build a multi-million dollar home, my valuation is pegged to yours. I can no longer afford to stay there. Somehow, that's not right.
Right. Highest and best use. Yeah.
So, do you see any threats looming on the horizon in California?
Sure. I mean, not necessarily in Southern California, but where you have residential uses encroaching on the waterfront, that is a problem.
So Morro Bay.
Morro Bay, yeah, possibly.
Yeah, so I think it's these competing uses is one of the threats, and there was an example a couple of years ago. San Diego was doing some planning for their waterfront, and they were looking at removing one of the marinas where the commercial fishing vessels were coming in and unloading. And when I was working for the National Marine Fisheries Service, we wrote a letter to say, explaining the importance of maintaining that facility. I don't think it was just our letter, but the city did stay with the original use. And so it was, again, that was an example of a competing use, because I don't know what their plans were, but it was probably to find a business there that was going to make more money, whether that was condos or container ships or what have you.
Does the Coastal Commission weigh in on the proposal of changing uses?
Certainly, yeah. And down in San Diego, we have a port commission that manages, which is made up of commissioners that represent the cities bordering the port. So change use is always a consideration, and any development in the coastal zone requires coastal review. But the idea of competing uses, I'm a native San Diegan and grew up there with the tuna boats. My wife lived in Point Loma, grew up with the tuna kids, and that's all gone now, and I mentioned the artwork that's right up. But a few years ago, we've been looking for a new place to build a Charger stadium. And, well, gosh, we got the Padres stadium right in the downtown area. Let's put the Charger stadium near it. It's just, talk about a convention center that shouldn't be next to the water. A football stadium that's used 16 times a year, maybe, with an ocean view. And one of the ideas they had is, well, let's go ahead and just build it above the 10th Avenue Terminal. So we can still have freight coming in, but the chargers will play over the freight. And you just got to wonder what some people are thinking about.
But I think we're going to take your football team away from you anyway.
Hey, you know, the way they played last Monday, maybe you could.
But we're going to stick them in some undesirable spot away from the coast.
There you go.
If you look at across the country, do some states do a better job of using the various tools to keep working waterfronts than others? And have you looked at this across different states?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tricky problem because, let me give you an example. In Delaware, for instance, the port of Wilmington is excluded from their coastal management program completely. Why? Because because Wilmington went to the legislature and said, hey, look, we are so important to the economy of Delaware that basically we cannot afford to be hassled by a coastal management regime. We're a seaport, leave us alone. And the legislature said yes. That argument has been used in some locations around the country. In California, what we do is we have actually port plans that are submitted and approved to the California Coastal Commission for Port Hueneme, Port of Los Angeles, Port of Long Beach, and Port of San Diego. And I don't think, up to this point, I don't think the coastal management program in California has really been necessarily detrimental to how our ports get planned. In most cases, the argument around the country is leave the port alone to do its business, that it's too important to the economy of this state. And it's kind of interesting because here these two ports, we're sitting in one of them, are the busiest seaports in the nation, and yet they aren't really inhibited very much by the California Coastal Commission. Right. So
I think that's true, but if I thought the way we did it in California, if you filed for a permit to have a change of use, not including the ports, that we would just drag out the permitting process until you died or went away.
Yeah, I haven't died yet.
Is that the way we do it?
You mean for waterfront use?
Waterfront use, not including a port, but if you wanted to propose something for the waterfront, there was a change of use.
It would be more difficult outside of one of the four southern ports that have established port plans, yes.
Don, you like a permitting process, so don't you?
There is a process. It's defined, and it is what it is. It can be cumbersome, but there are timelines set to it, and typically what confuses it isn't so much the commission's actions as the actions of folks that may not like the change and then use the public review process as basically a wrench in the works.
Right.
And we see that, and there's people that make their living doing that, which is unfortunate because, you know, a lot of times the sorts of things that get proposed are spot on why the ports are there in the first place. Back to the idea that Mark was talking about where they were thinking about taking out some commercial landings. There's an obligation of the Port of San Diego through the Tidelands Grant to provide a percentage of area to support fishing, and that's a federal mandate within the Tidelands Grant. So they're constantly looking for ways to facilitate fishing, but at the same time they're looking at an industry that's changed from what it was back in the 70s, which is tuna boats, down to an industry that's a total of $8 million a year now.
Right.
So it's hard to have the revenue generator from that when you compare that to the charging 7% on hotel tax on top of the residence tax, the overnight tax in the hotel room itself. I mean, the real money generators are tourism and, you know, large industries, and fishing just isn't that anymore.
No, the ports and tourists, we have the largest ocean economy of any state in the country by quite a sizable margin. If you back the ports out, then it is recreation and tourism. Mm-hmm. which is very important. And the problem, though, I think, is many of the people who work in that industry who wait on you when you go into a restaurant or change your sheets and in a hotel, they don't make enough to really live anywhere near where they work. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe with the change in minimum wage, we'll see some improvement. But you know, when I look at the California coast, I would have to say the Coastal Commission has done an awful lot of good, or we would have looked like Florida. Now, talk about a state that apparently had no notion of what to do. Anybody here a great fan of what Florida's done with their waterfront?
Well, there's a lot more waterfront in Florida than we have here. I mean, you compare us to the coast of Maine, and there's a place for putting little villages.
Yeah.
If we want to have a village on with its own port here in Southern California, we got to go dig the port out and put in a breakwater. And there's very few natural ports that we actually have.
And we did that, yes.
Yeah.
All right. So let's come back to ports. It used to be that in many of the world's great ports, like Rotterdam, the port was in the center of the city wrapped around it, people ate there, people came off the ships, they had the shops. With containerization, that all changed, even in Rotterdam. You're an expert on ports. What has containerization done?
What has containerization done for me?
For our waterfront?
Here's what happened. When before containerization, ships would come in. I mean, you know, go back and look once again at On the Waterfront. What happens? The cargo ship comes in. The stevedores and the longshoremen tie up the ship. The crane goes down in the hatch, and boxes, crates are put on the crane, and they're lifted out of the ship. And this all happens slowly, and the cargo goes into a warehouse that's immediately adjacent to the wharf, and it's locked up there until it's taken away by whoever owns the cargo. Okay, we go to containerization. There's no more need for the transit shed, the warehouse adjacent to the wharf, but we need room for the crane to unload container boxes, and we need room behind the wharf to place the container boxes. It used to be that we said, for every berth, every container berth, we needed 40 acres of space to stack the boxes. Now with these huge container ships, we're talking about 100 acres per mega ship in order just to stack the boxes. And the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach, we are even running out of space for the existing containers in the port. We're moving empties off the port property because there's just not enough room. I mean, drive down by the Hanjin terminal. I mean, and you can see just thousands of boxes stacked up. Those are empties at the very back of their terminal. So what's happened is that keeps the public away. I mean, first of all, for security reasons, post 9/11, we're keeping the public away from the container terminals to start with. Second of all, the container terminals have become so huge that you can't get very close to them anyway. And third of all, as Don says, there's so much stuff going on. You've got vehicles moving containers around. It's just dangerous to be there. But in addition to that, we've got trains coming in because our containerized cargo in the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach, much of it is going to other parts of the nation. So you have to have room for the trains. As you get next to the bridge, the Vince Thomas Bridge, there's a long string of track around there. As I came over this afternoon, there was a double-stack train there with certainly with dozens and dozens of cars loaded up with containers waiting to go to the east. Now, the public can't get into the midst of that. And also, it's just a huge infrastructure out here in the port. And in the Port of LA, what we've done is we've even extended the port, and in the Port of Long Beach as well, by dredging material, building rock dikes, filling it with material so that we can expand the container terminals. Now, is that a good thing commercially? Absolutely. But in terms of what it does as far as allowing people to get close to it, it's not happening.
No, and the same thing happened with the Port of New York and New Jersey, most of the major container ports. But if I wanted to really see a port up close. Where would you go? I might go to Savannah, where it's spread along the river, mm-hmm. or I might go to New Orleans, where again, it's spread along the river. You can get close to a working port.
Any of these riverine ports are more accessible than, for instance, Long Beach. Long Beach is one of the most inaccessible ports. I'll tell you another one, though, that is apparently is accessible but isn't really, is Oakland. Oakland, you can get right up next to it, but you're speeding along a highway. You can't really get that close to it, to at least understand it. Now, does that make a difference as far as a working waterfront is concerned? Well, if you're in an industry along there, you've probably got an office, a plant, something or other, a place to go on the waterfront. The advantage of some of these places, for instance, take LA Long Beach. The advantage of Terminal Island and the Wilmington area, and San Pedro for that matter, and Upper Long Beach, is that there are businesses out there that do serve the waterfront. And that's all part of this economic infrastructure. So they are a part of the working waterfront. And I mean,
But most of the people can't get close.
Most of the people can't get close to it, but at least we have a viable working waterfront.
Oh, absolutely. We certainly do.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite port where you can get close to what's happening?
My majority of my experience is with San Diego, and it's interesting because our most commercially exploited area is the 10th Street Terminal, and it's just south of the convention center, and they built a Hilton Hotel there.
Yeah.
When you're there at a convention or an evening dinner out on the veranda, there's a Dole ship tied up right next to you that's offloading pineapples.
Right.
So, you can have a margarita and watch the or pina colada and see the raw product coming
that's,
in at the same
that's
time.
That's the good part.
Yeah.
That's the good part, yeah.
All right, where do you go when you want to be close to a port?
It's a little bit of a drive, but I would say Morro Bay. You don't have the cargo containers in the way, number one. You can see a mussel farm or oyster farm out on the water. You see fishermen coming in with their catch, recreational boats going out. There's a launch ramp there for the recreational fishermen. So it's sort of what it used to be, I think, old time, to serve that purpose.
All right, let's switch gears. We talk about food security as it relates to the supply and access to food that we consume in the United States. What do we mean by seafood security in the U.S.? What's it like? And does seafood security for the United States have anything to do with our working waterfronts? And again, I'd like us to focus on California. Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, I think we need to identify or define what do we mean by food security. And the way I've always understood it, it relates to people having physical, economic, and social access to sufficient, nutritious, and safe seafood, or food in general, and then that would apply to seafood. In the United States, we are a seafood-consuming country. We eat more than we produce, so we need to import that. And so that really brings up this question of seafood security. Where are we getting our seafood? That now constitutes around 90% of the food coming into the United States, seafood coming in.
So 91%.
That number is some seafood we catch, we send overseas, it's processed, it comes back. So how we've sorted that out. But it's somewhere in the high 80 to 90%. And you look back in the 1990s, it was around 60%
right.
that we imported. So again, it goes back to is it sufficient? Is it nutritious? Is it safe? And I think sometimes we've seen seafood.
Is that
in.
Supply secure? And so Don, you said that our wild capture fisheries now around San Diego is something $8 million a year. Did you say?
Well, again, that if we're looking at changes of what's happened in our waterfronts, we're looking at the 40,000 jobs between Los Angeles, Long Beach, and San Diego that were wrapped up in the tuna industry has been reduced down to about 500 corporate jobs from the headquarters for the tuna operations. San Diego, if you Los Angeles Harbor is probably the biggest by volume harvester of seafood. Landings here is greater than anywhere else along the coast, but it's a lot of it's round haul fisheries, so you're looking at squid and anchovy, that sort of thing. Down in San Diego, the $8 million we're bringing in is more than half of that is spiny lobsters, which is a relatively small industry overall. There's one or two guys on a relatively small skiff. They operate in and out of smaller bays, and there's little, if any, processing associated with it. Back to the concept of seafood security and operational ports, I think what we need to do is take advantage of the existing infrastructure. As we mentioned earlier, it would be impossible to replace. We don't want to lose it, but we need to find a new paradigm for producing seafood utilizing that infrastructure that feeds into the existing downstream processing and distribution system, but for which we have a much smaller supply of seafood coming from capture fisheries into it. And that's where I think aquaculture can serve a function. It's interesting to me that a lot of the things that we need for an aquaculture industry already exist. Right. The vessel maintenance, the skills of the fishing community that exists now can readily be applied over into that, and then the processing and that sort of thing is available. The only difference being is we need some culture space next to the water where we can hold juvenile animals till they're large enough to be put out into open ocean cages.
Right. I want to come back, though, to the security issue, because it seems to me that importing 80 or 90% of our seafood, mostly from Asia, and knowing that the middle class of China is growing rapidly and they love seafood, and they've told us they will be exporting less, doesn't seem to me this is a very secure, stable supply of seafood that we have.
To me?
Well, Jim, you've been too quiet. Do you think it's a...
Fisheries is not my specialty.
Yeah, but that's never stopped you before.
No, it certainly hasn't. Don's point is very good about the land use issues. If the infrastructure is there, and it is, for instance, in San Pedro, especially the land side stuff, you don't want to lose that, because at some point, if we were to do, when we do offshore aquaculture, you need a place to obviously land the catch or the cultured products that you're bringing in. And as for the rearing space, boy, we don't really have that today. And how much space do you need? How many acres do you need? And obviously that's a rhetorical question, but you need a lot of space, right?
Actually, it's relatively de minimis compared to the amount of value that can come back in from it, and because you use it for a very short period of time with multiple crops during the year.
Okay.
So it's really a matter of getting the fish from a size of a gram to say 20 grams where it's large enough to go out into a cage, and that, depending on the species, that can happen within 6 weeks or 8 weeks. So you could literally put five or six crops a year out from a single space.
Okay, yeah. So that's a coastal dependent use.
Yeah.
Right. So since you're not gonna need your football stadium, maybe we could convert that into one of these.
Well.
So what's it going to take to make us more of a producer of seafood? Offshore aquaculture, what's it going to take to make that happen? Don, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that in aquaculture isn't just limited to the offshore area. I mean, there's some very progressive things being done here in California. The Humboldt Bay folks are looking to do the port up there, the harbor district in Humboldt, is going through the process of obtaining the permits so that if you want to be an oyster farmer, a shellfish farmer, you come in and simply get a lease and your permits for doing the work are taken care of. So you pay a fee and it's ready to go. And I think Ventura is considering the same sort of thing, which I'm fully supportive of, because it's an onerous process to seek all the different permits required And it's a disincentive because it's much easier. One of the big disadvantages we have for investment here in California is a short drive south of here is Mexico, and they want the industry, and they want to bring the product back up here and put it in our market. So what's going to be required is a regulatory framework that is conducive to investment, that doesn't force investors to say, you know, we're importing 91% of our seafood, I'll go to Mexico and I'll grow it there and we'll import 95% of our seafood.
And do you see that happening? Is that on the horizon?
In my lifetime, I hope, but I don't know how far away that horizon is, so it's hard to really estimate it. I hope it's something we can at least demonstrate in the next few years.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that part of what Don is also saying that's important to that is the public. The public needs to be aware of where their next meal, their next seafood meal is coming from. And you mentioned earlier if China is going to, with their increase in disposable incomes, and they're going to be consuming more of that fish that would have been coming here, and that's probably going to happen to Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and probably South America as well. Where are we going to get that seafood if we are going to maintain a seafood diet? And doctors tell us that it's you should. So the public needs to begin to start to understand that, I think, if this regulatory process is ever going to get streamlined and get rid of some of those roadblocks.
Go ahead. One of the things that we could do, our Coastal Commission could do, is to provide something akin to a programmatic permit. In other words, in this area, that, and you know, they could limit it to a volume
of production
in a given area, and then let that be that, instead of evaluating each operator on every single project proposed. And you know, it seems to me that is a way to kind of eliminate some of this bureaucratic logjam that comes up. And the opposition to that will say, oh my God, well, we don't know exactly what will happen. Well, of course you don't know what will happen until you try it. And trying it perhaps on a pilot scale and then enlarging it after studying it, if it appears that the project is feasible.
And that's what marine spatial planning is all about. We had what this aquarium proposed once, the creation of an offshore enterprise zone in which the base permits would be there. It would be zoned for those purposes. If you came in and wanted to lease a tract of land, you would have to post a bond, et cetera, and then agree to meet certain standards. If you met those standards, your lease would be extended in time and maybe in space. And if you didn't meet them, we'd throw you out and keep your money.
Now, on the programmatic plan, I thought that the state of California was moving in that direction.
Programmatic plan. Where are we with that programmatic? Don, where are we with that?
Well, I think we're 8 years into it. We don't have it yet. And literally, I don't think the programmatic EIR, I always envisioned it as being a template for CEQA. But my understanding is it won't serve that function. So it's an exercise that really has potentially not very much payoff.
Yeah. And we've been at it. We're assured that we will have it completed by the end of this calendar year.
Oh, yes.
But we heard that, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. All right, we're going to take one more, and then we're going to bring up the house lights and take some questions. And let's do this one quick. Do you see on the horizon any new uses of the waterfront that we haven't had in the past?
Yeah, energy. Energy, we do have energy coming across the waterfront today, but I think we're likely to see new types of energy coming across the waterfront. For instance, from wind-driven energy where the cables come ashore. Now, maybe not in a seaport, but certainly on a waterfront. And that'll probably restrict some access around where those cables come ashore.
Anybody else? Don.
Well, in visiting Pensacola down their harbor there a while back, I noticed that they were offloading blades and turbines for wind energy. Right. And you don't just drive these things down the freeway. They're too big. You have to bring them in by vessels. And it was just really interesting to me to think that You know, for us to have wind energy, even though it's on land, we need to have a coastal access to bring that equipment and bring it ashore.
Mark, do you see anything new on the horizon?
And nothing comes to mind. I think that the energy one is it's looming.
I think energy is, and while we've got one ocean desal, we may see more of that depending upon what happens to our drought. Let's bring the lights up and let's see who has a question or a comment from the audience. And we'll bring a microphone to you so that the thousands of people who are watching remotely will be able to hear your question. We got one right down here. And you can direct it to an individual or to the whole panel.
This is not a tough question, Jim. He told me in the beginning not to ask him a tough question.
Yeah, thank you.
Portugal, when it started out, was a very viable place to go, the kind that Jerry has described. There were a couple of good restaurants. You could watch the freighters going up and down. It was across from the Coast Guard station. Right. There was all kinds of activity there. And for some reason, it fell apart. And now they're talking about bringing it back to what it was. What happened to it?
The simple answer to that is that most of Portugal was in the hands of one developer, one operator, who owned restaurants all over Southern California. And over time, he had a long-term lease, and over time, he didn't maintain the facilities very well. And it has deteriorated, and the Port Commission in the Port of Los Angeles has been slow to respond as far as agreeing to a plan to revitalize the area. And it's a matter of the Port Commission having the desire to want to see that area redeveloped. And it's their responsibility. So,
other questions or comments? Anybody raise your hand and we'll bring you a microphone.
Here's the hostile one, Jim.
Okay.
Jerry brought up the issue of economic of threats to ports in California, in Southern California. But I didn't hear anything about the economic threats. That is, things developing south of the border. For instance, the expansion of the Panama Canal, a sea level canal, a port development in Mexico. We saw what happened with the tuna industry in the port. Might that potential also exist for the container industry here?
I don't think so. And I don't think so for a whole bunch of reasons. Number one, the expanded Panama Canal right now, the first expansion, okay, because there's a second one proposed as well by this Chinese investor who wants to build an even bigger canal across Nicaragua. I don't think, first of all, the expanded Panama Canal is too small for many of these bigger ships plying the Pacific. They still won't fit through it. Second issue is there's queuing at the Panama Canal. You have to wait in line to get through, and it's quicker and in some cases cheaper to bring the containerized cargo into LA Long Beach, have put it on trains and send it to the East Coast than waiting for the Panama Canal. As far as ports in Mexico, there is one at Lázaro Cárdenas, which is down by Acapulco, that is operated by a Hong Kong company, Hutchison Port Holdings, and they have a rail line that comes up through Laredo, Texas. They are actually expanding that, but it's in the Gulf of Tehuantepec with terrible weather. The other port proposal that is down in, that was, well, it is down in Baja, is at Punta Colonet. And the Punta Colonet project hasn't gone anywhere. It's south of Ensenada. And it would be creating, it in order to create a port at Punta Colonet, they'd have to create an entire city because nothing exists right there now. So that's probably not going to happen. This is heresy, but I will say it anyway. There is a point where moving cargo to the East Coast right now, I know that the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach would not like to hear this, but As far as moving cargo to the East Coast directly, it's okay for some of it to go. We don't need to be the absolute, you know, we don't need to be as big as, I mean, we operate, Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach handle four times the cargo of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. We don't need to handle four times, maybe three and a half times. Let some of it go to the East Coast. It's okay.
Any other questions or comments? You know, this nation was founded as a maritime nation. We were a leader in shipbuilding, in shipping, merchant marine, fishing. Most of those have gone. Now, you've got a shipbuilder in San Diego, but they can't build the largest ships. No. The one in Bath builds ships for the Navy. They can't build the largest ships any longer. You can't build one of the modern large ships anywhere in the United States.
Well, part of the reason you can't build it in the United States is that labor's cheaper overseas. And the margin in the containerized cargo business is so narrow, so slim, that you want ships built cheaply. I'll give you, this is ship talk, but when ships come in, one of the reasons that if you see a cargo ship, a container ship, coming into the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach, there will be a wire from the stern, and it looks like a tug is trying to pull it backwards. The reason is that the ships are directly, that the engines are directly coupled to the screw, and the minimum speed of most of these ships is sometimes in excess of 8 knots. There's a 5 knot maximum speed in both ports. So the tug has to pull on it to keep it from going too fast
right.
In the port. Because they're made inside, they're not unsafe, but they're just made as cheaply right. as they can to handle all this cargo.
So does it bother any of you though that we're no longer a leading maritime nation? You look at the merchant marine, we're aging. They're not quite as old as you, Jim, or me, but.
That's old, Jerry.
I think it's something that
just,
it is too bad. We've lost a lot, and I think the working waterfront is one of the things we just simply have to hang on to, and I agree with you, Don, that you know we need to become the leader in aquaculture, and all of the studies have shown that this country has the knowledge, it has the technology, we have the largest exclusive economic zone of any nation on Earth, we're one of the biggest seafood consumers on the planet, and yet we grow, what, less than 5%?
2.5%, most of that is catfish.
Right.
Not even using the ocean. Well, and on top of that, we have the largest exclusive economic zone of any nation in the world.
Yes.
And according to the FAO, the largest proportion of the largest area suitable for aquaculture development
right.
of any nation in the world. And yet Bangladesh produces four times the amount of seafood that we do.
And so when you talked about permits, I think in the federal waters, so outside of 3 miles, NOAA, I think, is the lead. But if you want to get a permit, NOAA can't issue that permit alone. You've got to go to the Navy, to the Corps of Engineers, EPA. If we're serious about it as a nation, set the bar high, but have somehow figure out how somebody can issue a permit if it's the right project.
Well, and I think, you know, most of the technology's there. I mean, they're doing it all over the world. And the demand is certainly here, the market's certainly here, and we've actually developed a lot of the technology that's used in other parts of the world. Our single stumbling block is, I won't say regulatory uncertainty so much as a lack of comfort on the part of regulatory agencies to have a pathway. I mean, most, and you've lived in the regulatory side of things, and when you're managing a fishery, you're looking at the stock of the fish, you're looking at the harvest rates, you're doing some calculations based on what can be gleaned off of that population and maintain it sustainably. In aquaculture, there's a lot of concerns that people have that the agencies don't have any real practical experience in their regions. And that's why I think the suggestion of pilot scale or small scale operations growing over time so that they provide that experience to the regulatory agencies would be an invaluable asset. It would also be a great opportunity for identifying the value of a nascent industry as it grew to the ports and the revenues that could be generated, the jobs that could be promulgated from it. And then at the same time, the agencies would have examples upon which and be able to predict. They now have empirical data to base models on to actually look at what the impacts are, if any.
I agree. All right, well, please join me in thanking our three outstanding panelists for a stimulating discussion.